2 hours after passing the world's largest wooden crucifix, Hassan brought it back up. "Did you already know that the world's largest wooden crucifix was in Kentucky?" he shouted, his window down and his left hand waving through the fast-passing air. "Not before today," Colin answered. "But I did know the world's largest wooden church is in Finland."
"Not interesting," Hassan said.
Hassan's "not interesting" had helped Colin figure out what other people did and did not enjoy hearing about. Colin had never gotten that before Hassan, because everyone else had either humoured him or ignored him. Or in the case of Catherine, humoured then ignored. Thanks to Colin's collected list of things that weren't interesting, he could hold up a halfway normal conversation. 200 miles and one pit stop later, safely removed from Kentucky, they were midway between Nashville and Memphis. The wind through the open windows dried their sweat without actually cooling them much, and Colin was wondering how they could get to a place with air conditioning when he noticed the hand-painted billboard towering above a field of cotton or corn or soybeans or something. Exit 212. See the grave of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the corpse that started World War I.
"That just doesn't seem plausible," Colin noted quietly.
"I'm just saying, I think we should go somewhere," Hassan said, not hearing him. "I mean, I like this interstate as much as the next guy, but the farther south we go, the hotter it gets, and I'm already sweating like a whore in church."
Colin rubbed his sore neck, thinking he would never spend another night in a car when he had plenty of money to pay for hotels.
"Did you see that sign?" he asked.
"What sign?"
"The one about the grave of Archduke Franz Ferdinand."
With little regard for the road, Hassan turned to Colin, smiled broadly, and then punched him softly on the shoulder.
"Excellent! Excellent! And anyway, it's lunchtime."
As Colin climbed out the passenger seat in the Hardee's parking lot at exit 212 in Carver County, Tennessee, he called his mum.
"Hey, we're in Tennessee.
How are you feeling, buddy?"
"Better, I guess.
I don't know. It's hot.
Did anyone call?"
His mum paused, and he could just feel her wretched pity.
"Sorry, love. I'll tell, anyone to call your cell."
"Thanks, mum. I gotta go eat lunch at Hardee's."
"Sounds delightful. Wear your seatbelt. I love you."
"You too."
After a relentlessly greasy, monster-thick burger in the empty restaurant, Colin asked the woman behind the cash register, whose body seemed to have suffered from perhaps a few too many meals at her place of employment, how to get to Franz Ferdinand's grave.
"Who?"
she asked.
"The Archduke Franz Ferdinand."
The woman stared at him blankly for a moment, and then her eyes lit up.
"Oh, y'all are looking for Gutshot.
Boy, you're headed for the sticks, aren't you?"
"Gutshot?"
"Yeah. Now what you want to do is pull out of the parking lot and you turn right, away from the highway, I mean, and then in about 2 miles the road's gonna tee. There's a closed down sitco there. You take a right onto that road and then you're gonna drive past a whole lot of nothing for 10 or 15 miles. You go up a bit of hill, then that's Gutshot."
"Gutshot?"
"Gutshot, Tennessee. That's where they got the Archduke. So a right, and then a right."
"Yep.
You'll have fun now, you hear?"
"Gutshot,"
Colin repeated to himself.
"Okay. Thanks."
Since its last paving, the 10 or 15 mile long road in question seemed to have been at the epicenter of an earthquake. Colin drove cautiously, but still, the worn shocks of the hearse creaked and groaned at the endless potholes and waving undulations of the pavement.
"Maybe we don't need to see the Archduke," said Hassan.
"We're on a road trip. It's about adventure," Colin mimicked. "Do you think the people of Gutshot, Tennessee, have actually seen an actual living Arab?"
"Oh, don't be so paranoid.
Or, for that matter, do you think they've ever seen a Jew throw?"
Colin thought over that for a moment, and then he said,
"Well, the woman at Hardee's was nice to us."
"Right, but the woman at Hardee's called Gutshot the Sticks," Hassan said, imitating the woman's accent.
"I mean, if Hardee's is urban, I'm not sure I want to see rural."
Hatton rolled on with his diatribe, and Colin laughed and smiled at all the right places. But he just kept driving, calculating the odds that the Archduke, who died in Sarajevo more than 90 years before, and who'd randomly popped into Colin's brain the previous night, would end up between Colin and wherever he was heading. It was irrational, and Colin hated thinking irrationally. But he couldn't help but wonder whether perhaps being in the presence of the Archduke might reveal something to Colin about his missing piece. But of course the universe does not conspire to put you in one place rather than the other, Colin knew. He thought of Democritus, everywhere man blames nature and fate, yet his fate is mostly but the echo of his character and passions, his mistakes and weaknesses. And so it was not fate, but Colin Singleton's character and passions, his mistakes and weaknesses, that finally brought him to Gutshot, Tennessee. Population 864, as the road sign read. At first, Gutshot looked like everything else that came before it, only with better paved road. On each side of the hearse, fields of squat, luminously green plants stretched out into a grey forever, broken up only by the occasional horse pasture, barn, or stand of trees. Eventually, Colin saw before him, on the side of a road, a two-story cinder block building painted a ghastly pink. "I think that's Gutshot," he said, nodding towards the building. On the side of the building, a hand-painted sign read, "The Kingdom of Gutshot, eternal resting place of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Ice-cold beer, soda, bait." Colin pulled into the store's gravel driveway, and buckling his seatbelt, he said to Hassan, "I wonder if they keep the Archduke with the soda or with the bait." Hassan's deep laugh filled the car. "Shit," Colin made a funny. "This place is like magic for you. Shame about how we're going to die here, though. I mean, seriously. An Arab and a half-Jew enter a store in Tennessee. The beginning of the joke and the punchline is sodomy." Nonetheless, Colin heard Hassan shuffling his feet in the gravel parking lot behind him. They walked through a screen door into the Gutshot General Store. From behind the door, a girl with a long, straight nose and brown eyes the size of some lesser planets looked up from an issue of Celebrity If Living magazine and said, "How y'all doing?" "We're okay. Yourself?" Hassan asked while Colin was trying to think whether a worthwhile soul in all of human history had ever read a single copy of Celebrity Living. "Just fine," said the girl. For a while they walked around the store, pacing the dusty, varnished 2x4s that comprised a floor, and pretending to consider various snacks, drinks, and minnows swimming in bait tanks. Half crouched behind a chest-high rack of potato chips, Colin tugged on Hassan's t-shirt, cupped his hand over Hassan's ear, and whispered, "Talk to her." Except in point of fact, Colin did not whisper, because he had never quite mastered the art of whispering. He just sort of talked in a slightly softer voice, directly into Hassan's eardrum. Hassan whispered and shook his head. "What's the total area, in square miles, of the state of Kansas?" he whispered. "Around 82,200. Why?" "I just find it amusing that you know that, but can't figure out a way to speak without using your vocal cords." Colin started to explain that even whispering involves the use of vocal cords, but Hassan just rolled his eyes. So Colin brought his hand to his face and nibbled on the inside of his thumb while staring at Hassan hopefully. But Hassan turned his attention to the potato chips, and so finally it fell to Colin. He walked to the desk and said, "Hi, we're wondering about the Archduke." The Celebrity Living reader smiled at him. Her puffy cheeks and too long nose disappeared. She had the sort of broad and guileful smile in which you couldn't help but believe. You just wanted to make her happy so you could keep seeing it. But it passed in a flash. "Tour star every hour, on the hour. Cost $11 and frankly aren't worth it," she answered in a monotone. "We'll pay," Hassan said suddenly behind him. "The kid needs to see the Archduke." And then Hassan leaned forward and stage whispered, "He's having a nervous breakdown." Hassan placed $22 on the counter, which the girl promptly slid into the pocket of her shorts, flagrantly disregarding the cash register before her. The girl blew a lock of mahogany hair from her face and sighed. "Sure is hot out," she noticed. "Is this, like, a guided tour?" Colin asked. "Yeah. And much to my ever-loving chagrin, I'm your tour guide." She stepped out from behind the counter. Short. Skinny. Her face not pretty so much as interesting-looking. "I'm Colin Singleton," he said to the tour guide slash grocery store clerk. "Lindsay Lee Wells," she answered, reaching out a small hand, the fingernails a chipped metallic pink. He shook, and then Lindsay turned to Hassan. "Hassan Habish, Sunni Muslim, not a terrorist." "Lindsay Lee Wells, Methodist, me neither." The girl smiled again. Colin wasn't thinking about anything but himself and K-19 and the piece of his gut he'd misplaced. But there was no denying her smile. That smile could end wars and cure cancer. For a long time, they walked silently through knee-high grass behind the store, which irritated the sensitive skin of Colin's exposed calves, and he thought to mention it and ask whether maybe there was some kind of recently mowed patch through which they might walk. But he knew Hassan would think that sphinctery, so he stayed quiet as the grass tickled at his skin. He thought of Chicago, where you can go days without ever once stepping on a single patch of actual earth. That well-paved world appealed to him, and he missed it as his feet fell on uneven clumps of hardened dirt that threatened to twist his ankles. As Lindsay Lee Wells walked ahead of them, typical celebrity reader crap, avoiding talking to them, Hassan just padded along next to Colin, and even though he hadn't technically called Colin a sitz pinkler for being allergic to grass, Colin knew that he would have, which annoyed him. And so Colin again brought up Hassan's least favourite subject. "Have I mentioned today that you should go to college?" Colin asked. Hassan rolled his eyes. "Right, I know. I mean, just look at where academic excellence got you." Colin couldn't think of a comeback. "Well, but you should this year. You can't just not go forever. You don't even have to register until July 15th. Colin had looked this up. "I actually can not go forever. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I like sitting around on my ass, watching TV and getting fatter. It's my life's work, Singleton. That's why I love road trips, dude. It's like doing something without actually doing anything. Anyway, my dad didn't go to college and he's rich as balls." Colin wondered just how rich balls were, but only said, "Right, but your dad doesn't sit on his ass either. He works like 100 hours a week." "True, true. And it's all thanks to him that I don't have to go to work or college." Colin had no response to that. But he just didn't get Hassan's apathy. What's the point of being alive if you don't at least try to do something remarkable? How very odd to believe that God gave you life and yet not think that life asks more of you than watching TV. Although then again, when you have just gone on a road trip to escape the memory of your 19th Catherine and are traipsing through the South Central Tennessee on your way to see the grave of a dead Austro-Hungarian Archduke, maybe you don't have a right to go and think anything odd. He was busy anagramming anything odd, any odd night, handy dog tin, doing thy DNA. When Colin did his DNA proud, he stumbled on a molehill and fell. He became so disoriented by the fast approaching ground that he didn't even reach his hands out to break the fall. He just fell forward like he'd been shot in the back. The very first thing to hit the ground were his glasses. They were closely followed by his forehead, which hit a small jagged rock. Colin rolled over onto his back. "I fell," he noted quite loudly. "Shit," Hassan shouted. And when Colin opened his eyes, he saw fuzzily that Hassan and Lindsay Lee Wells were kneeling, peering down at him. She smelled strongly of a fruity perfume, which Colin believed to be called Curve. He purchased it once, for Catherine 17, but she hadn't liked it. I'm bleeding, aren't I? Colin asked. Like a stuck pig, she said. Don't move. She turned to Hassan and said, give me your t-shirt. Hassan promptly said no, which Colin figured had something to do with Hassan's man boobs. We need to apply pressure, Lindsay explained to Hassan. And Hassan calmly said no again. And then Lindsay said, Jesus Christ, fine, and took off her shirt. Colin squinted through his glasses-less fuzziness, but couldn't see much. We should probably say this, but the second date, Colin said. Right, Perv, she responded, but he could only hear her smiling. As she wiped at his forehead and cheek softly with the t-shirt, then pressed hard on a tender spot above his right eyebrow, she kept talking. Some friend you've got, by the way. Stop moving your neck. The two concerns we've got here are some kind of vertebral injury or a subdural hematoma. I mean, slight chances, but you've got to be cautious, because the nearest hospital is an hour away. He closed his eyes and tried not to wince as she pressed hard against the cut. Lindsay told Hassan, apply pressure with the shirt here. I'll be back in 8 minutes. We should call a doctor or something, Hassan said. I'm a paramedic, Lindsay answered as she turned away. How the hell old are you? He asked. 17. Okay, fine. A paramedic in training. 8 minutes, I swear. She ran off. It was not the way Curve smelled that Colin liked. Not exactly. It was the way the air smelled, just as Lindsay began to jog away from him. The smell perfume left behind. There's not a word for that in English. But Colin knew the French word silage. What Colin liked about Curve was not its smell on the skin, but its silage, the fruity, sweet smell of its leaving. Hassan sat down beside him in the tall grass, pushing hard at the cut. Sorry I wouldn't take off my shirt. Man boobs? Asked Colin. Yeah, well, I just feel like I should know a girl a little before I trot out the man tits. Where are your glasses? I was asking myself that very question when the girl took her shirt off, Colin said. Couldn't you see her? I couldn't see her. Just that her bra was purple. Whatever, Hassan replied. And as Colin thought of K-19 sitting over him on his bed, wearing her purple bra as she dumped him, and he thought of Catherine 14, who wore a black bra, and also a black everything else, and he thought of Catherine 12, the first who wore a bra, and of all the Catherines whose bras he'd seen, 4, unless you count straps, in which case 7. People thought he was a glutton for punishment, that he liked getting dumped. But it wasn't like that. He could just never see anything coming. And as he lay on the solid, uneven ground, with Hassan pressing too hard on his forehead, Colin Singleton's distance from his glasses made him realize the problem. Myopia. He was nearsighted. The future lay before him, inevitable but invisible. I found him, Catherine said, and awkwardly tried to place the glasses on Colin's face. But it's hard to put glasses on someone else's head. And finally Colin reached up and nudged them up the bridge of his own nose, and so could see. Eureka, he said softly. Catherine 19. The end of the end. She dumped him on the 8th day of the 12th month, just 22 days shy of their one-year anniversary. They'd both graduated that morning, although from different schools, and so Colin's and Catherine's parents, who were old friends, took them out to a celebratory lunch. But that evening was for them alone. Colin prepared by shaving and wearing that wild rain deodorant she liked so much that she'd nestle up against his chest to catch its scent. He'd picked her up in Satan's hearse and they drove down Lakeshore Drive, the windows down so they could hear, over the rumble of the engine, the waves of Lake Michigan beating against the rocky shore. Before them the skyline towered. Colin had always loved Chicago's skyline. Although he was not a religious person, seeing the skyline made him feel what is called in Latin, the mysterious tremendum et fascinans, that stomach-flipping mix of awestruck fear and entrancing fascination. They drove downtown, winding through the soaring buildings of Chicago's Loop, and they were already late, because Catherine was always late to everything. And so after 10 minutes spent searching for a parking meter, Colin paid $18 for a garage spot, which annoyed Catherine. "I'm just saying we could have found a spot in the street," she said as she pressed the elevator button in the parking garage. "Well, I've got money, and we're late." "You shouldn't spend money you don't need to spend." "I'm about to spend $50 on sushi," he answered. "For you." The doors opened. Exasperated, he leaned against the wood paneling of the elevator and sighed. They hardly spoke until they were inside the restaurant, seated in a tiny table near the bathroom. "To graduating, and to a wonderful dinner," she said, raising her glass of Coke. "To the end of life as we've known it," Colin replied, and they clinked glasses. "Jesus, Colin, it's not the end of the world." "It's the end of a world," he pointed out. "Worried you won't be the smartest boy at Northwestern?" She smiled and then sighed. He felt a sudden twinge in his gut. In retrospect, it was the first hint that some piece of him might soon go missing. "Why are you sighing?" he asked. The waitress came then and interrupted with a rectangular plate of California Mackey and smoked salmon nigiri. Catherine pulled apart her chopsticks and Colin grabbed his fork. He knew a little conversational Japanese, but chopsticks eluded him. "Why did you sigh?" he asked again. "Jesus, no reason." "No, just tell me why," he said. You spend all your time worrying about losing your edge or getting dumped or whatever, and you're never for a second grateful. You're the valedictorian. You're going to a great school next year for free. So maybe you're not a child prodigy. That's good. At least you're not a child anymore. Or you're not supposed to be, anyway." Colin chewed. He liked the seaweed wrapped around the sushi roll. How tough it was to chew, the subtleness of the ocean water. "You don't understand," he said. Catherine placed her chopsticks against the saucer containing her soy sauce and stared at him with something beyond frustration. "Why do you always have to say that?" "It's true," he said simply. She simply didn't understand. She was still beautiful, still funny, still adept with chopsticks. Prodigy was what Colin had, the way language has words. With all the nasty back and forth, Colin fought the urge to ask Catherine whether she still loved him, because the only thing she hated more than his saying things she didn't understand was his asking whether she still loved him. He fought the urge, and fought it, for 7 seconds. "Do you still love me?" "Oh my God, Colin, please. We're graduated, we're happy, celebrate." "What, are you afraid to say it? I love you." She would never, not ever, tell him those words in that order again. "Can sushi be anagrammed?" she asked. Sis, he answered immediately. "Sis is 3 letters, sushi is 5, she said. "No, sis, the and the sis. There are others, but they don't make grammatical sense." She smiled. "Do you ever get tired of me asking?" No, I never get tired of anything you do," he said, and he just wanted to say that he was sorry, but just that sometimes he felt ununderstandable, and sometimes he worried when they bickered, and she went a while without saying she loved him, but he restrained himself. "Anyway, I like that sushi becomes sis. Imagine a situation with a game she'd invented where Colin found the anagrams and then Catherine imagined an anagrammatic situation. "Okay," she said. "Okay. So a guy goes out fishing on the pier and he catches a carp, and of course it's all riddled with pesticides and sewage and all the nasty Lake Michigan shit. But he takes it home anyway because he figures if you fry a carp long enough, it won't matter. He cleans it, fillets it, and then the phone rings, so he leaves it on the kitchen counter. He talks on the phone for a bit, and then he comes back into the kitchen and sees that his little sister has a big hunk of raw Lake Michigan carp in her hand, and she's chewing. And she looks up at her brother and says, "Sushi!" And he says, sis. They laughed. He never loved her as much as he did then. Later, after they tiptoed into the apartment, Colin walked upstairs to tell his mum that he was home, leaving out the possibly relevant information that he wasn't alone. After they'd climbed into the bed downstairs, after she pulled off his shirt and he hers, and after they kissed until his lips were numb, apart from tingling, she said, "Do you really feel sad about graduating?" "I don't know. If I'd done it differently, if I'd gone to college at 10 or whatever, there's no way of knowing if my life would be better. I wouldn't have known Hassan, and a lot of prodigies who push and push and push and end up even more fucked up than me. But a few of them end up like John Locke or Mozart or whatever. And my chances at Mozart dumb and done. Cole, you're 17. She sighed again. She sighed a lot. But nothing could be wrong because it felt so good to have her nestled up against him. Her head on his shoulder. His hand brushing the soft blonde hair from her face. He looked down and could see the strap of her purple bra. "The tortoise and the hare, okay. I learn faster than other people, but they keep learning. I've slowed down and now they're coming. I know I'm 17, but I'm past my prime." She laughed. "Seriously, there are studies about this shit. Prodigies tend to hit their peak at, like, 12 or 13. What have I done? I won a fucking game show a year ago. That's my indelible mark on human history." She sat up, looking down at him. He thought of her other size, the better and more different ones of his body moving against hers. For a long time she stared at him, and then she bit her lower lip and said, "Colin, maybe the problem is us." "Oh shit," he said. And so it began. The end occurred mostly in her whispers and his silence, because he couldn't whisper, and they didn't want to wake Colin's parents. They succeeded in staying quiet, in part because it felt like the air had been shocked out of him. Paradoxically, he felt as if getting dumped was the only thing happening on the entire dark and silent planet, and also as if it weren't happening at all. He felt himself drifting away from the one-sided, whispered conversation, wondering if maybe everything big and heartbreaking and incomprehensible is a paradox. He was a dying man staring down on the surgeons trying to save him, and with an almost comfortable distance from the thing itself, as it really was, Colin thought about the dork mantra. "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me." What a dirty lie. This, right here, was the true abdominal snowman, and it felt like something freezing in his stomach. "I love you so much, and I just want you to love me like I love you," he said as softly as he could. "You don't need a girlfriend, Colin. You need a robot who says nothing but I love you." And it felt like being stoned and sticked from the inside. A fluttering and then a sharp pain in his lower rib cage, and then he felt for the first time that a piece of his gut had been wrenched out of him. She tried to get out as quickly and painlessly as possible, but after she begged curfew, he began to cry. She held his head against her collarbone, and even though he felt pitiful and ridiculous, he didn't want it to end, because he knew the absence of her would hurt more than any breakup ever could. But she left anyway, and he was alone in his room, searching out anagrams for "my missing piece" in a vain attempt to fall asleep.